To kill children in cold blood went against the grain, and he would have found it hard to restrain himself from defending them, even though still greatly outnumbered, and he knew his people well enough to know that they felt the same. They reported back the condition of the settlement and left it behind them, the mood within the tribe growing as dark as the skies above them, the hours of daylight fleeting fast away. To mount their attack by night, even if only by chance, would give them a greater chance of success, as it would mean that the night gave them greater concealment. And yet, the tribe had been marching all day, and would fight better if it rested, if only for a few hours. The companions were aware of the mood changes within the tribe, and had noted the resignation with which Thompson had received the news of yet another settlement, where the inhabitants had fled to the comparative safety of Fairbanks.
Ryan, you think he has a plan for the firefight, or are we just supposed to run, shout, and shoot?
I don't think he'd know how to find his ass with both hands. But it wouldn't matter shit if we could rely on McIndoe. He's a good fighter, and he will have thought about a strategy. Problem is, part of that strategy will be taking us out.
At the head of the caravan, Thompson brought them to a halt. Jordan signaled back for Ryan to bring his people forward.
It lays over the ridge. Like ye, I've never seen the place. But before we plan, it would perhaps be as well to take a look.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Jordan led them to the lip of the incline. From the valley below, the glow of lamps, lit against the encroaching dark, cast a faint glow in the air. Lowering themselves, lest there were observers below, they approached the edge of the incline. It fell away relatively steeply, falling around 50 feet in total, over a length less than a quarter mile. Below them, in the basin of the valley, the Villa Fairbanks stood. It was their first sight, and whatever they had expected up to this point, those notions were now dismissed.
It'll be an intriguing challenge, would it not?
That isn't the word I'd use. If they know we're coming, and it's fairly certain they do, then we are well and truly screwed.
Fairbanks lay in the bowl of the valley, a collection of about 100 buildings, some of which were small shacks that housed only one or two, but the majority of which were larger buildings, some of two or three stories, that were either used to house several people or as places of trade and entertainment. If only a rough estimate, based solely on the buildings and the sounds, rather than any sight of the people, Ryan guessed that the Inuit were outnumbered, perhaps as much as 2 to 1. They had seen villas that size and with that kind of construction. The valley location gave it shelter, and the old pre-dark buildings that had survived had been augmented by cabins and constructions that had added to the size and security of the vill. Fate had protected it when the earth shifted, and those who made their homes in this barren area had welcomed the slight respite it gave, banding together gladly. It wasn't enough that they were outnumbered, and that the solid state of the vill gave it an impenetrable look, giving those warriors protection, while the Inuit had to approach down the exposed sides of the valley. There was one other thing that made Ryan feel the whole mission was a suicide charge, a feeling he didn't experience alone.
Oh, someone chill me now, because that's all we'll be doing if we take this on.
Thompson must have known. He must have. So why didn't he say anything?
Because then we not come. We make break and wristband farm then, not walk gladly in the chill.
I can see why he wouldn't tell us, but did he tell you?
The stranger within Doc had stayed silent while the others had expressed their disgust. Ryan had been watching the old man carefully to see if any more of Doc would try to break through. Possession or madness, Ryan didn't care. The point was that inside the head, now inhabited by the personality of Jordan, Doc Tanner still lurked. They had seen a brief glimpse of him, and if he were to reemerge, then it would ease their attempts to try to extricate themselves and the man himself from their predicament.
I had no idea. They did not tell me. From the way it was described, it was an ordinary wee town, not something that looked like Edinburgh ready for an English siege.
Ryan had no idea what that meant. Something that the personality calling itself Jordan had dragged from its memory centuries before. But there was no mistaking the tone and emotion of the voice in which he spoke those words. Jordan was having doubts about the success of the holy mission. And frankly, Ryan couldn't blame him. For the thing that made the Villa Fairbanks appear impregnable was the wall that stretched around the perimeter, forming a ring that had only one way in and one way out. It was not the first time they had come across a vill that was protected in such a way. Indeed, for a larger vill that had been built from pre-dark remains and had been established since people first began to crawl from the new cost, it was an obvious move. But they had never seen a wall quite like this before. It had no sec posts. There was little need, as to try to scale it would prove to be impossible. The wall was partly constructed of rock hewn from the sides of the valley, and partly from huge blocks of ice that had been ripped from the land around. These rocks and ice blocks had been built into a construction that stood as high as some of the two-story buildings, perhaps 40 feet, perhaps a little less. It was hard to judge when looking down into the valley, with jagged edges that would have given a plenitude of foot and handholds, if not for one simple precaution. When the wall had been built, it had been covered with water that had frozen into a layer of ice that now made the ascent of the defense nothing short of impossible. No doubt that, as the weather gradually chipped at the sheet ice, it was replenished in those areas that the elements themselves didn't refresh. It was a simple move of dramatic effect, using the constant low temperature to furnish a defense that did away with the need for manpower. As for the only entrance, it consisted of a set of doors less than half the height of the wall, cobbled together from wood and metal sheeting. On each side was a tower with a covered crow's nest atop that housed, as far as could be seen, 2 men per nest. The doors looked flimsy in comparison to the wall, but then they didn't have to be strong. A force bottlenecked into attacking through this one spot would be easy pickings for both the sec-men in the crow's nest and for any armed citizens who waited patiently behind the last line of defense. Short of sending out parties to mine the wall, thus blowing great chunks from it to gain access, there was little that could be done to breach the defenses with any degree of success. As Ryan looked to his people, he could see that they felt the same way. Come to that, he could tell from the expression on Jordan's face that he too shared those thoughts. But what was Thompson's great plan? Did he have one? They had to find out. Ryan began to pull back from the lip of the valley. Unless the Fairbanks sec had scouts, they would be aware that the Inuit were coming, but not that they'd actually arrived. The downside to the Ville's splendid isolation was that such a scout party would be hard to send out covertly. It was reasonable to assume that they had some time in which to rest and form a strategy, so they'd better use that time wisely. Following Ryan's lead, Jordan pulled back with the rest of the companions and headed straight for the chief, who was seated in a small group that also contained McPhee and McIndoe, as well as the sec chief's trusted lieutenants. Jordan strode ahead of the companions and heatedly began to shout before he was upon them.
You did not tell me of the walls, like Edinburgh, like Jericho. Saints alive, man, do you expect us to shout and the whole thing comes tumbling down upon the enemy?
Thompson said nothing. His expression betrayed little, but his frozen posture suggested he was taken aback by the sudden explosive anger of the stranger. It was McPhee who answered.
Surely the Almighty will guide you in this, as he will us. Should you not have your own plans?
Plans? How can I have plans when I had no idea what the damn town looked like until a few minutes ago? You people are the ones who live here.
There is something we can do. If, and only if, you've got anything more than blasters in your armory.
Yeah, like some more of that Plas-X?
We might have some Plas-X.
Good. Then we may be able to get this attack going, if you've got the balls to help us.
How the hell do I get myself into this kind of shit? How the hell do any of us get into this kind of shit?
Mildred and Christy had circled the perimeter of the valley and were now approaching the wall around the rear of Fairbanks, almost 180 degrees from where the majority of the Inuit rested, awaiting first light and the beginnings of an all-out firefight. The two women had scrambled down the incline and kept low as they ran across the flat valley floor toward the wall, armed with Plas-X and detonators. They weren't alone. Ryan's plan had been simple and had quickly enthused both Jordan and the Inuit leader as a certain way to gain access to the Ville. McPhee had kept his own counsel, and in a sense, Ryan didn't blame him. It was a strategy, but it was in no way a certainty to obtain the desired result. It was a possible solution, and perhaps more importantly for Ryan's people, it would enable them to test the resolve of McIndoe and his sec force. Would they take this as a chance to try to eradicate the companions, or would they put that to one side and treat it as a chance to make their mission successful? If the former, then it would be one-on-one, and Ryan's people could take on some of their enemy, sending a message to others who would try to take them out. If the latter, then it would mean that their attention was now focused on their primary objective. This being the case, it would possibly make it easier for the companions to snatch Doc and make their escape in the chaos that was sure to ensue. Either way, it would have a bearing on Ryan's future strategy. So it was that five parties of two were armed with what J.B. estimated as enough Plasex to blow holes in the wall, making points of entry and possibly weakening the structure enough to cause a chain of collapse around the circumference. This last would be difficult to achieve. J.B. had little more than a glimpse at a distance and in the dark on which to base any calculations. Any success would therefore be more luck than judgment, and any resulting collapses, beyond the points of explosion, a bonus. Mildred and Christie were paired, while Jack and J.B. moved together. Ryan chose to go with McIndoe. It would give him a chance to sound out the Sec Chief. Four other Inuit Sec warriors were paired. Each team was given enough Plasex to cause the requisite damage, and instructed on where to place it on the wall. J.B. was surprised to find that the Inuit had a large stock of explosives, which he could only attribute to stockpiling from the vills they had earlier decimated. If nothing else, it explained why the Sec Chief had been so free with the explosives he had used to try to blow them away. The fact that he was now revealing this to them did little to allay J.B.'s concerns, although he could understand Ryan's tactic in trying to draw the hostile Inuit faction into the open, forcing them to either stand and fight or sublimate their hostility to the greater cause. And Ryan had arranged it so that each Inuit pair was split by a pair comprised of his people, and he and McIndoe made the most difficult assault of all, that upon the front of the wall, having to plant Plasex as near to the entrance as possible without detection. The one-eyed warrior reasoned that this would be the advance that would determine how the Inuit Sec Chief would play out the whole combat situation. So while he and the impassive Inuit advanced silently down the slope, trying to pick out the few brief respites of shadow offered by the contours of the steep slope as they descended quickly to the valley floor, the other party set off around the lip of the valley and began their own descents. Ryan used his wrist chron to count off the start times for those who had the farthest to travel, trying as best he could to stagger the parties so that they would be planting their Plasex and setting their detonators with as much synchronization as was possible. Mildred and Christie, as the pair who had the farthest to go before beginning descent, had set off before any of the others, and by the time they were on the valley floor, they were both beginning to feel the effects of the journey. They came upon the wall without being detected. They could sacrifice speed for stealth, as there were no sentries on this darkened side, the night being accentuated by the shadow of the rock and ice.
Oh, shit! I can see why they don't bother guarding this.
Mildred reached out to touch the surface of the wall. The ice covering the block construction was slick and beyond cold. It almost burned to touch.
Bastard to climb, all right. But more to the point, how the hell do we get the Plasex into the wall? I was kind of hoping you'd tell me that.
Mildred stepped back and looked up at the towering construction. About 5 feet above her head, a patch of ice had cracked and fallen, leaving a crevice between rock and ice block that could hold a charge. The problem would be gaining the height. Climbing the rock would be impossible. Only one thing for it.
How strong you feeling, girl?
Christie followed Mildred's eyes up to the point in the rock.
Why me? Why can't I be the one who places the charge?
Because I've got no Gaia power to call on if you dislocate my shoulder. Besides, I called it first.
Oh, I can't argue with that, can I?
Christie dropped to one knee, and Mildred clambered onto her shoulders. Steadying the pair of them, Christie carefully climbed to her feet and advanced slowly, planting her legs apart in front of the wall to try to spread the weight and balance. When Mildred felt that Christie was solid, she carefully raised herself, 1 foot at a time, until she was no longer kneeling, but standing on Christie's shoulders. She tried to balance speed with the desire to avoid causing Christie pain, and winced on her friend's behalf as she felt the woman's shoulder muscles tense beneath her boots and heard Christie's breathing grow more labored. Ultimately, it was simply a fact that Christie was taller and had a more developed musculature than Mildred. It made sense for the smaller woman to plant the Plasex, but this didn't prevent a twinge of guilt as she fumbled for the gaps between the rock and ice, wasting precious seconds. She gently prodded the pliable Plasex into the gap, then set the detonator before placing it in the explosive. It was tempting to jump down and spare Christie another second of agony, but she was aware that one wrong landing could make things harder. A turned, sprained, or broken ankle at this point would really screw things. So she lowered herself carefully, Christie's hands reaching up to guide her down.
Doesn't look like the tribe is interested in getting rid of us right now. I just hope they've got their charges planted.
More than we have. Think we can make enough of an impression down here to get the second charge planted well enough?
Just do our best.
They chipped out a small section of the ice at the foot of the wall, using a knife given them by Jack to dig out the hard earth underneath the overlap of ice and levering up a section, almost snapping the blade before the ice cracked enough to give them a small hole at the bottom. Some of the charge would blow out into the earth rather than into the rock and ice, but there wasn't the time to make a further impression. They would have to hope that this blast, combined with that of the higher charge, would be enough to have the desired effect. Charges now planted, the two women made their way back across the valley floor, keeping a steady pace. They needed to be swift, but the efforts of planting the charges had taken a toll, and the ascent up the steep valley side would take no little effort. The rock and ice were slippery underfoot, with little to assist them on their passage to the top.
Shit!
Muscles in their calves and thighs burned with the effort of climbing such a sheer incline at such speed. It was with relief that they made the top, pausing for only a second to catch their breath, before starting the long haul back to the Inuit camp. At least they hadn't been attacked by a rogue Inuit. Ryan had sent them the farthest, despite the extra effort, as he reasoned that the rear of the wall would be the safest spot. JB and Jack had taken an area that could still, at a pinch, be seen from the crow's nests. This demanded more caution and the greater stealth skills of the albino youth and the armorer. Like Mildred and Christy, they had found the most difficult part of the task was actually finding somewhere in the ice wall that would take the charges. Once they had placed them, they had little problem in getting back to the base camp, where Jordan was waiting anxiously for them, flanked by Thompson and McPhee, who was now finding it hard to mask his skepticism about the whole attack. Like Mildred and Christy, Jack and JB had encountered no problem with the Inuit Sekmen who had been dispatched at the same time, and figured as their distaff companions that the Inuit would save any attempts to be rid of them until the full-scale attack took place. Indeed, when they returned, they found that one of the Inuit teams had already returned. Before too long, the second Inuit team joined them, with Mildred and Christy not far behind.
Did you do the job well?
Did the job. Have to wait to see how well.
There was only one pair who hadn't yet returned. The companions exchanged wondering glances. What was going on? Ryan and McIndoe had the least distance to cover. What was keeping them?
Time to reload. Deathlands is continued on the next CD.
Remember when you could go to a movie for $3.50? Graphic Audio is a movie in your mind, and it can cost as little as $1.70 an hour. For what listeners, authors, and critics are saying is the most sensational entertainment of its kind. There's nothing else like it. Call 1-800-670-5220 or log on to our website at www.cuttingaudio.com. By the way, some of our customers are telling us to send their graphic audio books to a fuel desk on their route. What's a good place for you? Let us know, and we'll have your next graphic audio book waiting when you get there. For your convenience, this information is also printed on this CD and on the container of this graphic audio book. Call 1-800-670-5220. See what's playing in your imagination.